big round of applause for Carla Aguilar. It's so good to see so many faces back here this afternoon with us. Welcome to everyone. What we're kicking off now is a panel called Not Dead Yet, Progeny of Indie Media. And we have some really special guests with us today. Before we dive into the panel, we're going to watch a brief video that was sent to us by a compañero that wasn't able to make it down, Sphinx. And Dee, I don't know if you mind saying a few words about Sphinx, and then we can watch the video that he sent us. We just got this yesterday from him.
Sphinx is from Amazonia, which is the English-speaking area of Cameroon. And I think Jim was there recently doing radio work. I've known Sphinx for quite a while. We were on a panel together at Exit Art when that existed and talking about indie media. And I was blown away by his skills and passion for indie media. He explains himself on this tape, his deep appreciation of indie media. He has put together, I think it's now 8 convergences of people from Africa and amazing groups. We had a Deep Dish was able to fund that through some of this Glazer money to hold a meeting in Senegal during the social forum, and there were people who came from, I think, 11 African countries. It was amazing. And there were workshops, including a workshop by a man that he talks about on the tape, Swari, who was a Nigerian media person who led a workshop there and is now in prison and in Nigeria. He is the founder and the host of a website called Sahara Reporters, which is supposedly the biggest website in Africa. It gets a tremendous amount of traffic. And one of the people who attended those workshops was a man from Kenya named Stephen Nyash with a radio station called, what's it called? Something with an OOT in it. I don't know. Moot or Coot or something. Anyway, but he, not that long after he did the workshop, he was murdered. He was clearly for his work on the radio station. And he's, along with Brad Will and Giovanni from Genoa, he's one of the martyrs of indie media.
Happy anniversary, indie media. I'm sorry I can't be with you in person, but know that I am with you in spirit. My appreciation goes out to all those who were in Seattle 2 decades ago. I got involved in indie media 2 years later in Germany, and it was entirely different from any political group that I had ever been involved in before. The principle of participatory cooperation and horizontal decision making were a powerful tool for the empowerment and political education of regular people, and a bulwark against the sort of political opportunism that distracts most political groups. In indie media, we did not get ourselves all confused by fighting over who would be the biggest big guy. Instead, we just did the work. I consider my indie media comrades to be my most trusted comrades because I know they don't do it in order to get a job, to build their resume, or to be affirmed by a title. I know they do it because they truly believe that by building different technologies and different media, we could help build a different world. I want to take a moment to remember the comrades that I work with through the Indymedia Africa Working Group who have passed on. Victor Tekwe, my dear comrade from Ambazonia, died from an illness in 2016 after years of dedicated service to the struggle. Stephen Nyash, my dear comrade from Kenya, was shot point blank in 2012 in front of his home in the Korokocho slum of Nairobi, where he worked as a trailblazing radio journalist. Floribert Chebaya, with the voice of the voiceless, my dear comrade from the Democratic Republic of Congo, was assassinated in 2010 by the French neo-colonial regime in Congo. He had responded to an invitation by Congo's Inspector General of Police, surely related to the half dozen human rights campaigns he was running at the time. He sent his wife a text message to inform her he had arrived at the police headquarters in Kinshasa. His naked remains were found in the back of his car in a different part of the city a few days later. A year later, the chief of security at the police headquarters testified that he saw Floribert's assassination on a surveillance camera and that his assassination was personally ordered by the then French colonial despot in Congo, Joseph Kabila. All three of these comrades influenced me deeply, but recently I am especially thinking about the conversation I had with Floribert back in the day. He was trying to get me to understand that something was not right with the way the big human rights organizations were reporting about their struggling in the Congo. I didn't get it at the time. I thought, why would Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, etc., misrepresent this movement? What would they have to gain by it? Our people must be messing up, I said this to him, and we argued about it intensely. Now, 3 years into the revolutionary movement in my home country of Ambazonia, also known as the former UN Trust Territory of Southern Cameroon, or as some people prefer to describe it, English-speaking Cameroon, I'm having flashbacks from these conversations with Floribert, because we are experiencing the same pattern of distortion that he was describing to me. A person might feel incredibly helpless in this situation, but I don't. And one of the main reasons I don't is because I have Indymedia as a living example. I remember how we reached clarity that we could not trust the mainstream media, period, and committed ourselves to build a workable, movement-led alternative. I know we can do the same thing for human rights reporting, and that doing so would save lives and defend revolution across the African continent and beyond. This is what I'm gearing up to focus on. If you want to help me with this, please reach out to sphinx@indymedia.org. I also want to take a moment to call out the names of my Indymedia African comrades who are currently in jail for their political work and to ask all of you to help get them released. Omoele Shiwori and Agba Jalingo of Sahara Reporters are currently being held in Nigeria. You can see more information about that on freeshiwori.org and cpj.org. These two comrades work with us for the Indymedia African Convergence that happened both in Senegal, in Dakar, Senegal, and the one that happened in Accra, Ghana, most recently. I also want to use the opportunity to talk about the journalist Manto BBC, Sia Conrad, our Paul, and Felix Ndalem, and many other Ambazonian journalists who are currently being held by the French neo-colonial regime in Cameroon. You can see more information about them on the website ambazoniapocs.net. So that website is ambazoniapocs.net. Thank you so much for keeping the flame lit. Free Shiwori and all political prisoners. We are all correspondents.
Let's welcome our panelists. in person. And I want to remind folks as you listen that this is a conversation, and at some point we're going to open it up and everyone's going to participate.
Oh, okay.
You get to follow us next.
Yeah, no big shoes. I'm Rachel Clark. I'm local here. I'm with the Houston Independent Media Radio Show that has been on KPFT, I want to say, for 16 years now. We each introduce ourselves,
yes.
Or I just
go ahead.
Well, just to provide some context, I think what we were thinking about doing was each introducing our project and talking about it for about 5 to 10 minutes, and then we'll be able to start with, in that time, why we're not dead yet, and strategies for how we're staying alive as a focus beyond just talking about our project. And then we'll move on to thinking about what's next. So, Rachel, go for it.
Oh, okay, great. So, like I said, the Houston Indie Media Radio Show, it started out as a 30-minute show. It's currently a one-hour show, and it is on KPFT 90.1. That is one of 5 Pacifica channels, and I think a lot of how we have managed to stay relevant and stay on the air is because we do work within that, you know, we do have the radio station as a way for us to get our broadcasts and our projects out. That being said, and I don't want this to sort of divert into a conversation about sort of the complicated politics sometimes at Pacifica, but that has presented some growing pains as well. On KPFT specifically, we have occasionally, generally we cover local grassroots movements and also try to link those to the larger global context. Over the years, we do still do on the streets reporting and those sorts of things. But recently, as we were able to get an hour show, we've been able to add more analysis and those sorts of things and been able to have more long conversations. For example, even on Friday's show, one of the things we were able to broadcast was a piece of the kickoff to this, thanks to audio that Renee provided, in terms of as we are reflecting 20 years after the N30. Some of the other things, though, is that at times we have reported on the station and some of those politics, and that's been complicated. We've done that sparingly because while we don't want to get into the mudslinging, we thought it was important to really grapple with some of the things that, the issues that were being present at KPFT and at the larger Pacifica station. One of the interesting things that happened when we made that decision, and we made it knowing that there were ramifications potentially, but at the same time as journalists, we had to speak to the firing of Dr. Obadike Kamau, who was the first African-American general manager. And what we did was we were very careful. We used quotes that people had made in public meetings and also quotes that were made in the Houston Chronicle. As a result, the station called us and told us that we were going to be canceled for violating a gag rule. And but as a result from that, what was really surprising and amazing, because a lot of times while we are still sort of trudging along, you don't really know what your reach is or whether people still listen. And it was amazing to see the amount of support we did get from the community that came out to board meetings, that took to social media or took to other platforms to basically call out the attempted censorship. So one of the really cool, amazing things that happened as a result is then our show was extended from 30 minutes to an hour. So that was, you know, very exciting. We are about between 5 to 7 journalists that collaborate, but a lot of also what we do is, while we no longer have set trainings, and that's something that we constantly talk about, is how to reconnect with that part of giving people training and allowing them to use these great media making tools that are in everybody's pockets. We also have community contacts. So a lot of times people will just come to us and say, hey, I have this story, can I come in and can we talk about it? Well, yes, absolutely, because that's very much in the vein of what indie media continues to be. And so those are sort of some of the things that we've been doing. And like I said, KPFT has been a huge way that we've been able to keep our message out and keep getting the word out and keep making media, but that's not without its complications or its challenges or dialogues and discourses, and those are things that we even continue to have as a collective. And also just sort of, you know, making sure that we are also continuing to make great radio week after week.
Hi, my name's John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of the Independent newspaper in New York City, and I wear a number of hats at the Indy, both on the editorial side as well as running much of our, I guess the business side of the operation. And in a minute, I'm going to queue up a couple of short videos to give a kind of a sense of where we are right now that we made, and then kind of talk about how we got there. Before we do any of that, I'd like to give a special shout out to our co-organizers this weekend, Renee Feltz and Tish Stringer. I had a little bit of a front row seat to see the organizing unfold for this. I remember when Tish came up to New York in June and sitting around the table and listening to Tish and Renee talk about their plans, and this was still sort of a gleam in their eye, but there was definitely momentum. And to see that how it's all come together and the sacrifices they each made, they're both very busy people, and they took the time to make this all happen and to bring it together. And I think that's because of their love for indie media. That's why we're all here today, is because Tish and Renee felt so passionately that this had to happen. And so, again, thank you guys. So anyway, we have two just short videos. One that we put out at the end of 2017 when we were doing our year-end fund drive, but it kind of gives a sense of kind of our presence in the New York City community. And then there's a second, that's about 3 minutes, and then there's a short one-minute video from when we were distributing the paper in June of 2018. We had put a little-known congressional candidate on our cover named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which nobody had really heard of at that point, and we basically inundated the subway stations of Western Queens with that issue, and it gives you a little bit of a sense of what that was like, and then I'll talk some more.
Donald Trump's election a year ago shocked millions of people and propelled many of them into political activism for the first time. Here at The Independent, we've also stepped up. In the past year, we've more than doubled our print circulation to 40,000 copies a month, with news boxes on street corners across the city that allow us to reach New Yorkers from all walks of life.
The Independent, amen? That's I-N-D-Y, Independent, hallelujah.
I sort of became very active in the 60s, and I loved the underground press. When they asked me to distribute the Indie, I said, of course. If I see friends, I give it to them. I bring a bunch to the library, because I think it's just so important. It's really the only paper like that around today.
I feel the Independent provides a platform and a voice for those people who don't have one. It informs and incites the political consciousness of the people. The level of the storytelling and the journalism is just top-notch.
And the Indy is also adapting to the digital age. We have this brand spanking new website that's seamless, easy to use, and it's updated several times a week. So you can get more of the Indy in between every issue.
Our following on social media, The Independent, has grown massively, which enables all our articles from our contributors, our volunteers, to go far beyond New York and spread through the whole world.
The Independent gave me the opportunity to learn the craft and also to communicate with the kind of audience that would be interested in the kinds of critiques of policing that I've been developing over the last several years.
I like to the Indie because it provides me a venue in which I can develop analysis, but also it provides me with a sense of a collective community.
It's just important for people to have the experience of picking up a newspaper that's for free. One thing that New Yorkers do all the time, since you don't really need to have a car here, is you read. That literary hunger needs to be fed. I think the Indie is one of the best ways to feed it.
Even though people are reading this individually, they're really part of a community, the community of Indie. So I intend to continue to financially support Indie, and I really do encourage everyone to do something and donate too.
In this day and age that I hate to even say is the Trump era, we need independent journalism more than ever.
We can do more great journalism in 2018 and continue growing the Indie both in print and online, but we can only do this with the support of our readers. Please visit our website today and make a contribution.
Let's support the Independent. It's our alternative free paper for free people. Amen.
Anna Noguera, who's here in the audience, it started as a gleam in her eye, and she recruited me very early on to come on board with what was getting underway. And we were very fortunate at New York City Indie Media that a benefactor named Emmanuel Goldstein, who had made his name as a sort of a legendary hacker, he had a loft space right in the middle of Manhattan that we were able to move into, bring our computer equipment and whatnot. It was about a 2,000 square foot space. It had a kitchenette, shower, multiple rooms where you could have meetings, do video production, newspaper production, the whole thing. And several of us would live there as well. Anna had a small space up in a front cubbyhole. I moved into a 3x8 storage closet in the back of the office and lived there for about 2.5 years. So I like to say the rent was cheap and the commute was short. So too bad it didn't have any heat, but you know, can't have it all. So that's how we kind of got rolling. So it was sort of it was with a community media center and a little bit of a squat as well. Another person who lived there for a while was Brad Will, and so a really transformational moment for us was when 9/11 happened in New York. I mean, we'd been the kind of agitprop paper of the global justice movement in New York and had started, carved out a niche for ourselves, but the immense tragedy of 9/11 and all the implications that came out of it really sort of forced us to kind of take our game to a higher level. And we did two special editions very quickly after 9/11. The first one came out 48 hours after 9/11, and it was only a 4-page issue, but like we hit all the issues that matter. We asked, are we headed for a downward, spiral of war? What will that mean? That the coming anti-immigrant backlash, the crackdown on civil liberties, the role the media would play in propagandizing the whole society, and I think that put us on more people's map, and so we started to get a flood of volunteers coming in. The people like, I can't stand watching another minute of this television coverage. I've got to be a part of something that's countering that. So it brought way more people in, and I think brought a lot more attention to us, but also in that insane post 9/11 environment, we were the only anti-war paper in New York, and WBEI, the radio station, was anti-war as well. But you were really a lonely voice, and amid other media shrieking for revenge. So we had to, felt like we had to do an even better job. That the arguments we were going to make, the articles we were going to publish, had to really make sense and be well, written and thought out. And I think that was a good process for us to go through. Onward from there, we've kind of become the diary of the New York Left, and we did special editions in advance of the Iraq War. We did a whole series of issues in advance of the 2004 RNC. We kind of became the newspaper of the resistance that was building all summer in New York. And of course, eventually the movement, the global justice movement that we came out of, would eventually peter out in many ways, certainly in the United States. But we were able to keep on going, in part because we were really invested in the idea of journalism, not the sort of corporate Pavlov style journalism, but a journalism that really got out in the community, talked to people, covered stories that mattered to their lives. So we were able to keep on pushing ahead like that. In our first several years, we did kind of depend on the momentum of convergences or mass protests like the anti-war protests and the RNC, but we found we could keep on going, because there was no lack of stories to cover. You just had to be attuned and willing to do it. And we still really drew on social movements and organizers and people who are trying to make change from below as a real sort of source of our journalism. And I remember something one of our readers told me one time when I handed a paper to her at a subway station. It was, if I want to know what's going to be in the New York Times in 6 months, I can read The Independent. And I mean, just a couple of examples of stories that we were way ahead on. And we had a college student from CUNY who was down in Oaxaca, Mexico in early 2006. She sent us a dispatch about this radical teachers union in Oaxaca that was organizing some protests, and that became the movement that took over Oaxaca City and controlled it for months. Anyway, we had a dispatch from the mountains of Oaxaca that saying this was coming 6 weeks before it happened. And then we had a coverage from something called Bloombergville in the summer of 2011, which was sort of the proto-Occupy Wall Street. It was a couple hundred people camped out on some sidewalks across from City Hall demanding that Michael Bloomberg not cut, a lot of essential services. And we were the only newspaper or website in the city that covered that. And a lot of those same organizers were the ones who launched Occupy Wall Street 3 months later. And we talked about how this is like a tactic that we might see more of. And then, of course, I mean, like we saw here with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we were really the only newspaper in New York City that took her campaign seriously. The Intercept did a good job of covering it, but that was more for a national audience. And the assumption, of course, was that her opponent, this longtime congressman and machine boss, was untouchable. And something I learned when I went to talk to her supporters, they had all been canvassing and phone banking, and they told me whenever we talk to people in this district, nobody even knows who their congressperson is because he hasn't been around and he hasn't had any competition for 20 years. And so that was a real signal that something was afoot, because it was obvious that she was running an energetic campaign, even if nobody actually knew who her opponent was. So the question would be, all right, so we've been able to do a lot of good work and grow over time. I mean, we're now at a point where we've published 40 to 45,000 copies a month. They have the online presence as well. But in terms of the, what were the challenges that we faced along the way, they would probably be familiar, I think, to people from a lot of different indie media projects. And these were difficult contradictions to resolve, but we tried to come up with creative solutions that felt right for us. Of course, one of them was how to hold down an actual space in the middle of Manhattan, of all places. And because while Emmanuel initially made the space available to us for free for the first couple of years, after that he started to ask us to contribute to the rent. At first it was $1,300 a month, and then it started to go up, and after 5 years, the landlords were sick of us, and then we had to just leave entirely and find other space. And one of the ways we did that was we subrented the space, and we kind of like what folks in Urbana-Champaign have done. And we after Anna moved out, we put some sheetrock around her cubbyhole, and turned that into a room that we rented to people who lived out of there. One of them was EP. It's a small world, and we did other rental things to bring some of that money in, and then in terms of the broader challenge of money and fundraising, when you have a newspaper, there's this cost you're going to have. Even at that point, when we had no staff at all, we still had printing expenses and whatnot, and our circulation was starting to grow. And the first big fundraising project we pulled off was when we did that big anti-war issue. We had a center spread that had a map in it of the weapons of mass destruction, the WMD program of the United States. We were hearing all about what Iraq was up to with their fictional WMD program. And so we showed where all the sites were that WMDs were developed in the U.S. We went later and turned that into a 24x36 poster with a whole coded key to it and sold it at anti-war demonstrations up and down the East Coast and to other outlets, community radio stations who wanted to use it as premiums. And we made $25,000 off of it. We sold 5,000 posters, made about $25,000. And that would later become the seed money. It helped us get through 2003, but some of that became the seed money for hiring our first staff, like creating a paid staff position. Myself and another fellow, Jed Brandt, we were the first two staff people, and we were getting paid $600 a month. So it was pretty meager, but it helped. And I had landed in a rent situation for almost next to nothing. So I finally gotten out of the storage closet and just needed a little bit of money to make rent. And you know, that there was some controversy around that. I think some people in indie media, when they got wind of it, felt like this was a sort of at odds with, you know, the spirit of indie media. But we felt like that, you know, actually having a staff that could be present on an ongoing basis actually gave us the capacity to do more. I mean, we were talking about this a little bit yesterday as well. You know, we could do, you know, more trainings, more more reporting, more of everything we were doing if we had full-time staff. And I was at a point, I mean, where I told people, I don't think I can do a third winter in that unheated storage closet, so I'd really like to get out. And people understood, and fortunately we had some reserves left over from the poster project. And so I was able to move out of the storage closet and have a real home and keep on doing, you know, all the work we were doing before. And another sort of challenge we faced was, you know, how to be a participatory journalism project, yet to deal with the fact that the people who were participating had, you know, widely different skill sets, including people who had little or no journalism experience at all. And while it was fine that people could kind of post whatever on an indie media newswire, you know, for a newspaper project like this, where there's like finite amount of space, and we were trying to reach a public audience that wasn't just a sort of self-selecting indie media audience, you know, we felt like we had to consistently hit a certain level of quality to be credible and interesting for people to want to read, especially in New York. I mean, New York is a more competitive media environment. I was doing a lot of distribution work as well, and when we put the paper out, at least back then, there was all sorts of newspapers in the city, so you're just kind of thinking like, somebody's going to actually want to pick up this newspaper. We've got to like hit a certain quality threshold, or they're not going to pick us up outside of like a small circle of our friends. So the way we sort of resolved that tension was we started doing a lot of reporting workshops where in Skillshare, so that people, you know, we didn't treat being a newspaper reporter like being a, you know, nuclear physicist. This is something you can learn through, you know, with a certain amount of mentoring and practice. And that's what we did, and it was really great to see so many people come in and develop their skills. And after they would do the workshops, they'd come to our meetings, and we'd try to assign them a story to do for the web or the paper. And you know, some people found this was something they could really get into. Other people kind of realized, well, maybe I don't want to be a reporter, but I still really like this project, and they would get involved in other ways. So I think we were able to keep an egalitarian spirit, but while still kind of dealing with the reality that it's important to acknowledge there's, you know, differences in skills, and the idea is to lift people up instead of just sort of not acknowledging, you know, the reality we were in. And something else we always did was, whether it was, you know, distributing newspapers or getting the subscriber mailing out or whatever, we really, you know, I tried to emphasize that we should all be involved with this as much as possible, that whether you're like an editor or, you know, your first week at the paper, everybody should be in on the grunt work together. And I've certainly, you know, always been more than willing to do my share of that, and most of other people at the paper have too. I really think it's, you know, maybe it's not essential, but to me, I think it's important that people not feel like, oh, I'm too good to do this or that. It's not, anyway, that's not the kind of organization I want to be a part of. So that's, I guess, some of the trajectory. And again, some of these contradictions we dealt with about how to hold down a space, how to, you know, deal with money or staff or hierarchy. They were difficult, but I think sometimes, you know, leaning into these contradictions instead of running away from them was like the healthy way to go, because in trying to find solutions for these, you know, difficult questions, it enabled us to grow, but grow from our strengths. And I sometimes think it, at times maybe indie media or certain indie media centers maybe became a little, you know, brittle or doctrinaire about what was indie media and you know, kind of held the principles of unity up as kind of like some sort of, you know, scripture that came down from the mountain. And so we tried to really hold to the spirit of indie media, but be flexible enough to make it work for us in the environment we found ourselves in. And we're still trying to do that today. There's no final solution to any of these like fundamental questions. And you know, we're still, you know, trying to be a participatory project. The challenges of fundraising and money are probably greater than ever because we have a larger operation than ever before. And yeah, but anyway, that's more or less how we managed to survive and still be operating today.
I'm Brenda Miller, and
we're just going to actually tag team this.
We're going to share, right? So
is this annoying to have this projected on you?
Oh, no, but I can't see what it is.
That's just here. It's just our very, very old, very first version of our website as indie media. So we're going to talk about how we went from indie media to the Hudson Mohawk, to the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Go ahead.
So we were the HMIMC, and we would like hang around together, trying to report on whatever we could, being in little edities together in circles, editing like all night long. And we were in a place called, we were in the YWCA in Troy, New York, in the Harriet Tubman Peace Room. And they asked us to leave, and I think they asked us if we were too political, although they said it was a space issue. So Troy, New York is filled with abandoned buildings. We were really inspired by AMC. Also by our Urbana Champaign, we found an abandoned church in North Troy, New York, which is one of the most economically disadvantaged communities in the state, and also one of the most environmentally devastated. It's right at the northern tip of the Hudson River estuary between the Hudson and the Mohawk River. We moved in there, and we thought, maybe it's more space than we need, but maybe it is more need than media production, what we've been doing as media. So kind of part of how we are not dead yet is a series of strategies and struggles that I'm going to try to keep synopsis and pass to you of the early history. We moved into the church and realized, okay, let's have any events, like things that can't be shown anywhere, that aren't about Almighty Dollar, that aren't about passive viewers in the audience, and we are really hoping to open this up, actually, and here's strategies and tips from all of you, too, in this session. So we started doing productions. Our first one was Marx in Soho, a play, and it was leaking from the roof, and everybody had umbrellas in the audience inside. going to today, just showing kind of the shift, we just got a $50,000 grant from NISCA to put in air conditioning, finally, after 15 years. So we've been slowly building up this church and doing events and doing productions. Basically, we had like this kind of traumatic struggle that actually made us stronger than ever. And it was in 2008, we had brought in an artist named Wafa Bilal. Actually, brought him into RPI where we both teach. And we were called the Den of Art Terrorism, and our whole arts department got closed down. The sanctuary, some of you might have heard the story, the sanctuary invited Wafa to the sanctuary, and the city of Troy closed us down, and it was like really big deal. And had selected code violation, our doors were 3 inches too narrow. New York Civil Liberties Union took our case, and we settled, and the settlement was that they would fix our doors. They also would match a grant that we got from the NEA Creative Placemaking. And we had a grant proposal called Found Art in North Troy. And we made, I don't know if I'm going to just go a little clip of Freedom Square, but we built Freedom Square as kind of a resistance. You know, this is the beginning of building Freedom Square. Actually, we brought Isaiah Zagar, who's an outsider artist from Philadelphia, Magic Gardens. He did the Magic Gardens. And we did participatory art workshops with the community, hundreds of people made the most primal form of media they could, media messages, on clay. And was Mosaic. We built the stage, and we are, you know, we had, like this summer, we had Spirit of Separate Deaths, which was an 8-part concert series featuring women of color and gender non-conforming musicians, and also a women's resource fair. So we've gotten to the point where we've built an outdoor stage in this a block that had like 10 abandoned buildings on the weekend. So we obviously started, like, and then one day I was planting a shrub in the ground and I realized, oh, people are talking to me because my hands are in the earth. So we started like taking abandoned lots on this one block inspired by Detroit and what they're doing. We ended up, we now have what we call an environmental education campus with 8 buildings, abandoned buildings, transformed abandoned buildings and lots in one city block. So I guess our story about Not Dead Yet is about building physical infrastructure, okay? As a way that nobody can fuck with us, okay? Mm-hmm. And we actually have a lot of old weather underground people around us who come. We specialize after that moment of becoming art terrorists in always inviting radical guests in every single season, right? And just pushing it. But we also, at this point, you know, have EP interviewed every council person, all those right-wingers, just now on the radio. So, you know, we really have kind of gotten to be part of the community over 15 years. And I'm going to just pass these out as I do my final comment. But basically, we realized that the indie media spirit was about independence. And media is the arm of all these other issues that we're all fighting for, peace and justice, environmental justice. We changed our mission to actually incorporate that. And at this point, it's really art, media, and science that come together, all as DIY movements, as indie movements. And I'll just pass this out to people who don't have it, but you'll see this cute little illustration at the front for anybody who doesn't have it. Here, I'll just pass a few back. But really have the synergy between art and media and science. So now we have a low-power FM radio. We did a lot of work with Prometheus Radio. We also have a program called Nature Lab, which is really, really important for us. North Detroit Art Technology and Urban Research in Ecology. And in a way, what we learned is that part of our struggles is that we're getting older, you know. And in the second session, of this discussion, we're going to look at, you know, what's next? 3 to 6 months, 3 to 6 years, you know, 20 years? Do we look for 20 years? But a lot of the people who have the institutional knowledge of this struggle might not be around in 20 years. So how do we build infrastructure? Part of it, how we're not dead yet, is to think about how do we build infrastructure that's going to go on into the future? So a lot of our focus has been actually on this Nature Lab program and hooking into the environmental justice movement as it's growing, you know, and as it's inspiring young people, and not just staying isolated in the media, but really understanding media as the powerful tool for all these other kind of intersectional movements. And with that, I will pass it on to EP, who will give more specific description of what we do there.
Thanks, Brenda. I guess just sort of maybe going back to go forward, you know, we started in 2000. I think for us, our first mass mobilization was Quebec as a group. And when we came back, that's when we launched our local indie media center. And, you know, thinking about, you know, a lot of, and I think other people have, like a lot of the media centers, independent media centers, came out from these big mass mobilizations. And what did it mean to be kind of like this nowhere place of Troy, New York, and jumping on the indie media bandwagon? And what did that mean for us? And we had, you know, a group of people that were media makers from the universities, and we had a lot of peace activists. And I think it was that moment of creating in our very small place this cross communication. And we took on like a lot of projects. Like we made, I think I mentioned somewhere this weekend, we used to, before having a space, we would gather in Brenda Miller and Steve Pierce's attic and create these little editing bees. And we did like a whole bunch of this stuff, and we like tried to have it out like sort of like in this like DVD sort of professional sort of way. And we made it a series of these, but this one sort of specifically stands out. It's Independent Media, the War and Peace Trilogy. And, you know, we were like trying to like sort of network and, you know, work with our connections at Democracy Now. And we got Amy Goodman to co-release this DVD, which had one of her talks on it, Independent Media in a Time of War, that we sort of illustrated. But we also created like a study guide to go along with it. We had gone down to F-15 in New York City and created a half hour short on that. And we did this project called Women's Faster Peace. And we were like in these like really dedicated editing bees to make these little videos with study guides that went along with them and try to distribute them the best we could. But Amy ended up at that time selling a book and going on a book, her first book tour, I believe. And she brought these along with her and showed that talk at some of them. And she sold these, and we negotiated that we'd get $1 for everyone that she sold. But for us, that was a really big deal at the time. So, you know, we started collecting those dollars, and it really helped us. I think it was like also this time where we were freshly, then we got our space shortly after that. This, yeah, we used that money to get our space, to help get our space. But I think one thing about having a space and shifting from like this indie media going to convergences was that once we got our space, we really needed to, like you said, put your hands in the ground, but set root, and we really started working really, really locally. Like I feel like that block, that campus has really been our main focus of knowing and learning our community outside of the people who pass through the university, and really being a resource for this community has become a lot of our focus. And beyond just becoming a resource for our community, it's, you know, how do we keep making media? And, you know, we worked with Pete Trudish and Prometheus Radio Project, and, you know, we applied for in that little window to get a low power FM station, well, three, because we have a really big idea that it's going to be networked between Albany, Schenectady, and Troy, and we're working on it. But right now, we're really focusing on using our radio station to sort of amplify our other projects, and we do an hour long daily community produced by mostly not journalists, so it's sort of interesting in this way of how we create people and up people's skills with workshops and trainings to help people participate in this volunteer daily radio show, which has been going on for 2 years now. So we're working on that as well as sort of like, you know, trying to do like more than we can handle with like, you know, we have this radio show, we have this documentation of like every event we do with like four cameras, and as Brenda said, Nature Lab, and food is a really big deal, and Uptown Summer Youth Program. So we're trying to like really, situate ourselves there and think about how we're gonna keep doing it longer. I know there's something else I was supposed to touch upon, but I feel like maybe this is a good time for us. There was a question yesterday around, someone asked, I think, in Anna and Evan and Danielle's panel, like, what are people doing today? So I was just wondering if we should just take maybe a minute to see if anyone wanted to contribute in that way, like, what... You know, for us, we're still writing grants, but we're diversifying our grants. We're have a place where we rent out and for low rent to bring in some money. But how do people, not only money wise, but project wise? Does anyone want to share your strategies now that you've heard the three of our project strategies?
Or if people had any follow up questions.
Yeah,
We get a little bit.
And how is it that you're such prolific property owners?
Well, the properties are worth almost nothing. They're actually liabilities more than they have value. We also, our biggest strategy is to keep everything absolutely as low as possible, every expense. We really try to keep our expenses at the bottom. You know, we have our own tower that, one of our media people climbed a very tall tree to put the translator in. So, the whole thing is bare bones in everywhere we can, but we're growing to a point where we can't depend on that anymore. One of our first big struggles as Indie Media was to get some of the grants, we needed to have a nonprofit. So we took on Media Alliance, which was a kind of a defunct nonprofit that was sitting in boxes at the WNET offices in New York, and we became Media Alliance. And so we're a nonprofit. We had one staff person, Steve Pierce, who probably many of you know in this room. He probably does about 8 jobs in one, and we would never be able to do it without that kind of passion and dedication. But we then expanded. We're just lucky. We do every strategy we can, you know. So I'm a professor at RPI, and he's my partner, so we don't have to pay insurance for him. He gets insurance from RPI. I work for free. and we shouldn't put that on the internet, because there will be a conflict of time. Resources, how can you use every institution you have to kind of fortify spaces of resistance, right? So, and then now we've expanded in staff. I was just going to say our second position was a development director. Our third position is in flux right now, but it's development director. It's a volunteer coordinator.
I didn't touch on what I asked you. How is it you were able to buy 8 buildings?
They're so cheap.
Nevertheless, did you have
a bank? It's a deindustrialized city with a something.
Yeah,
a
basically these houses are either going to be torn down and into a negotiation with the land bank, and they're saving the houses from being torn down and their agreement to help fix them up, or they're on the foreclosure market. And
and you take on the tax burden?
Yeah.
Well, but if you're a nonprofit after a year, then you don't do the tax. So we have one lot that was $200. We bought the sanctuary, I think, for $30,000. We just bought a carriage house and lot for $10,000.
I think our overall mortgage is under $1,000 a month.
Our whole mortgage.
For the whole campus. So that's just where we're at is what makes it possible in some way.
The burden is on a very few number of people, and so as we get the staff that needs to keep it going, how do we become more sustainable? So we started a sustainer campaign. We were depending totally on like grants, which is like completely impractical. We don't have the rent opportunity of Urbana Champaign. We're very jealous of that, actually. It's a great question. Yeah.
Thank you.
So,
Ms.
Gagwood, I think you talked about, are there ways to circumvent it? And also, how much time do you spend rectifying fake news these days?
Great question. Well, the gag order, that's sort of a separate conversation. There's some discussion about whether or not there really is a gag order. However, like I said, we generally make a conscious decision not to get involved in a lot of the specifics because it's very complicated, the dynamics at Pacifica and at KPFT. However, there are times where we have, in fact, gone ahead and what we do is, like the last time we went ahead, we just really try to be very conscientious as journalists as far as citing other resources, giving people ample time to comment, and trying to just do our due diligence as journalists. The other thing that we brought to light the last time that our show was nearly canceled was that Bloomberg is the only other news outlet that specifically outlaws its journalists from speaking to when issues within the agency or within the organization take place. So that's just kind of the way that we have navigated it. Now, fake news, that's, I think, something probably all of us grapple with, but a lot of it is just what a lot of the news we do, we try to talk to people on the ground, whether recently it was Chile or we When we're talking about Houston ISD, you know, we talk to grassroots organizations like Community Voices for Public Education, where those are parents and educators and public education activists all sort of working together. And obviously you try to, when you are using other content, when we first got started, we used a lot of, like I'm sure everybody else, a lot of other IMC coverage. And so now we're using other resources like It's Going Down, which is sort of a consortium of a lot of left and anarchist groups putting different podcasts and things. And so, you know, it's really just also, and we continue to keep, like I said, not just local connections, but also broader connections in the state and across the country. And it's really just also just checking your sources and doing things regardless as responsible journalists that you, you know, need to do.
The First Amendment restricts the government's ability to curtail free speech. It doesn't have any effect on private corporations or organizations.
It's a contract.
Mm-hmm.
How's Albany doing? They were just getting on the air. It was last year, right? Year before. Yeah,
they are on the air.
Are you keeping your relationship with those guys? And stuff?
Yeah, we are. Basically, they're working on a plan that's a little different than ours. We put all our energy into a one-hour program and then syndicate Pacifica, Sprouts, all these other sort of programs, Democracy Now, and air those programs throughout the day and do our own jazz show at night. They're actually recruiting and have a cast of people that would do it typically like they're doing hours after hours. Like everyone gets their own shows, hour long shows. Is that what it is? They're working. They're moving forward.
It was really inspirational. Check out all the names. Very impressive.
Yeah.
I'm opening up
for a few more
minutes. Thank you.
Question about your media footprint. We know how far KPFT can reach. You know, it goes all over Southeast Texas. But as far as the newspaper, what is your distribution like? How far do you get out of New York City? As far as what's going on in Troy with LPFM, like how many potential people can you reach? What's your what wattage is your transmitter? What is your footprint or potential footprint? Media-wise, for both of y'all.
Sure. So with the newspaper, the print edition that we come out with each month, the readership is primarily in the New York, in the five boroughs and in the surrounding metropolitan area. And we have, starting about 3 years ago, we started putting news boxes out on street corners in the city. We have about 60 boxes out right now spread across the city, and we're in about 70 public libraries, and we're in various social movement centers, some laundromats, independent bookstores, cafes. And one of the cool things about the boxes is that often we have volunteers that will take papers from the boxes to then take to their schools or back to their apartment buildings. Or I ran into somebody one time I happened to be walking by, and they were like, we were taking 25 papers out of our box. I was like, hey, what's going on? And he had like a little lanyard on, and he worked at a city hospital. He's like, oh, I take, you know, your paper in AM New York in for people who are in the waiting rooms to have something to read. So there's so much, those boxes open up all sorts of other circuits of distribution that I don't even know about all of them, to be honest. And then we also put all our newspaper material online, and then we do original reporting between issues. And I would say, based on our Google Analytics, at least half or maybe more of our online readership is outside of New York City. So there's definitely, the articles are read by people beyond New York. About our
how many copies of the paper do you print?
About 40,000 to 45,000 copies a month, and and when we print them up, we used to distribute them all ourselves, and somebody had somebody with a pickup truck. truck, go out for about 3 days putting the beavers out, and when we jumped from like 15 to 40,000, we realized that wasn't possible anymore, and we have a distributor who also distributes about 40 other publications in New York, and we give them the route sheets, and they put them out, and you know, we make sure that they're, you know, doing the job as they should be, and then we also keep some papers in reserve to hand out at cultural events or protests or, you know, other events like that. So, and the boxes themselves, we have these bright red and white stickers on the side of the boxes. So if you're walking around New York, I mean, you can see that box from like a block away. So it's also a great form of sort of promotion and advertising for ourselves. So yeah, the boxes have been a huge boost to our visibility and impact. And one other thing about having a newspaper as opposed to, say, like a website, when you put something on the cover and then you have all these boxes, like, it definitely makes an impression on people that, with the AOC issue and some of the other issues we've done where we've had a prominent cover, having it everywhere in those boxes definitely makes an impact.
And Troy?
Well, Troy, our radio station actually covers larger than the city of Troy. So for a low power FM, that's
how many watts?
Do you know?
100 watts.
It's really low power.
We have overlapping signals in three spots.
So basically, this is our map, which I think actually goes a little bit further than this map that's described here. But I think for us, people do listen to us online, but for us, every segment is turned in from our producers on SoundCloud, and the whole show is put up on SoundCloud as well. So I think a lot of people consume the show through social media, which is kind of hard to keep track of. I try to use like a little, this is from October, but there's, you know, the only thing this, you know, it's not that many listeners, but the cool thing about it is we started in 2017, and each year more people are listening to us. So
do you have two repeaters? Is it Hilly?
We have at least one repeater. The antenna is up on the property out in Brunswick, and I think there's at least one repeater at the water tower.
The rooftop in Schenectady.
The rooftop in Schenectady is another transmitter. Is the Schenectady station.
Everything on the same frequency?
No. Three separate.
So we're really trying to look at how radio and is operating on a platform in the internet age too. A lot of the people who are participating are way more excited about that. So we're really looking at what is radio in 2019.
And for us, you know, part of it is like this idea of collaboration. So there's a radio station down in the Hudson Valley that goes to our SoundCloud, and they pick up segments and that relate to their community, and they broadcast those there. And we've been putting some thought into and communications with other people around how we can also incorporate other people's stories on our program. So we don't have it nailed down yet in terms of, you know, we've taken some stuff from the Hudson Valley, but we are trying to figure out a more sustainable way of collaborating with other media makers, not just in our media center.
One of the things you didn't mention is the tremendous use of interns. And
Beatles. I mean, and there were people who came, they came from, way up in Canada, north of Quebec, and drove all the way down so they could see, because this was like unbelievable if these people were there. Now, they didn't pay them what these people really were, but what they did was, when they left, they had a full color, four camera shoot DVD, which they couldn't have afforded to do. It's an absolute pristine, great tech. And also, there was a young woman who made coloring books, coloring papers of each group that came. And so that while kids came to the concert, in there coloring the little pictures of that group. So that group became this famous group that they'll take home and put up in their room. I mean, it was amazing. And they were trying to get all the copies, they were getting copies of it, of this coloring book. I mean, they'd never been in a coloring book before. They were thrilled. So it was an amazing, wonderful concert. And I don't know how much did you pay them.
Well, we actually got real funding for that one. It had a match by 50%. It was an economic development grant from New York State. And I mean, it's interesting because even with the big budget, you know, a free concert, free food that came from the gardens on our block, we were disappointed in our audiences because Troy, New York, or our neighborhood of Troy, New York, is not a destination spot.
No.
So in some ways, it's an opportunity to get, you know, a development opportunity of like art for tourism's sake. I mean, we can reframe ourselves depending on what we need. But just one real quick thing about what you said about the intern. It makes me think about when I grew up as a radical media artist. You know, it was physical spaces that I needed to go to where I would be mentored, where there'd be other communities, where there'd be visiting other media makers. That like nurtured all of us, right? And these spaces are less and less and less. So what we find is when the interns come in, I mean, we're having a problem having to supervise all these interns, right, without the resources to do it because there's a hunger out there, you know? And it's still a very small percentage, but when they get in, they're like, wow, I didn't know that there were places like this. They've lived their whole lives now where they don't really, you know, have that experience of coming out of the cultural 60s or even community spaces. They're in such a corporate world, right? And so it just is kind of an affirmation about how important it is to have physical infrastructure, right, and also how needy we are now of having that information, networking, online infrastructure that I feel like there's this big gap right now because we're producing all this media that's actually incredibly important, but it's kind of like, you know, the tree that falls in the woods. So that's one area we're really struggling.
Should we use that for Tran?
You had a question.
What you just said, Brenda, reminded me of something that came up this weekend, which is that those of us that continue to do independent media and its various projects no longer have any media network to put it out to. And that's, so I was curious, you know, what that's been like for all of you. Have you made new networks? You know, is that a challenge for you? Is that something we should all take away from this? Like, you need to get networked again somehow. I'm not sure what it looks like, but just want to throw that out there.
I mean, I think for us, we would benefit from networking with people. I think it's been very inspiring to me personally to hear from a lot about Danielle's project from Champagne Urbana. I can imagine there's other projects like this that would be really great to network with. But like it makes me think about like, yeah, Renee, what's next? Like, I don't know. I would love to be in a place where I could network with other projects that are thinking about similar challenges that we're thinking about, especially, you know, we did go to the Grassroots Radio Conference this year for first time in a really long time, And that was a nice place for us to network about our radio project, but we have so many sort of tentacles out there right now that that's not the only project that would be cool to like get some feedback from other people who are really awesome at doing this. I mean, we're building a community that are not media makers into media makers, and sometimes, you know, it's awesome and fun, and it's also, there's not like colleagues on this level besides like Steve Pierce or like Brandon Miller to really like float ideas around with. So I think for me personally, it would be very nurturing to have that network beyond getting our content out to other folks. But people, I don't know, maybe we should answer this, but I also feel like I've been hearing murmurs of like two types of projects coming out of this. Like people are sort of talking about, can we network in some way? Other people are like, can we archive what we've all done with indie media in some really cool way? And I don't know, for me personally, I would like to hear people's thoughts on those or whatever projects I didn't hear about that people are thinking about in this way. But I pass the baton now.